hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
You tonight, I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing.
Each and every night, we're going to bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Credit cards, air travel, video games, television, all giant industries today. But once they were new markets, and in fact, listen to the numbers. 42 of America's 50th largest companies are based upon exploiting markets that were once new, and plenty more profitable new markets are waiting to be tapped. They are out there. And today's low-growth economy makes it all the more essential to find them. But only companies who get it right are going to find them. Stephen Wonker with us. He's the guest of Capturing New Markets, How Smart Companies Create Opportunities That Others Don't. He's the founder of New Markets Advisors. And after earning degrees from Princeton, Columbia, and Harvard Business School, he helped build the innovation strategy firm Innosight into a dominant player in the field. And let us say, Stephen, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Stephen, when it really comes down to it, and we take a look at it, new markets, capturing new markets, there's so much opportunity out there, but the key is there's so many people who don't know how to do it, who don't know how to take that first step. Once they're there, they're good, but it's opening that door. What was it in your experience that caused you to put the information about capturing a new market to pen?
It really came from two sources. First, as you mentioned, I have a background in strategy consulting, both with Clayton Christensen running my own firm and also previously with one of the big strategy firms, Bain & Company. And I saw that a lot of people in that profession were really good at solving very well-defined problems in well-established industries. But new markets are totally different, and the toolkit that you're going to use in an established industry just doesn't apply in a new market. So I saw a lot of what we were doing, not only as strategy consultants, but what we were teaching in business school was misguided for people who were out there trying to create something that's fundamentally new, and of course that's critically important to economic growth. Then on the other side, as you mentioned, I have a background too as an entrepreneur, and so I could think through my own experiences, and I realized that so much of the literature that's out there about innovation and entrepreneurship and crafting strategy for new industries really isn't easily applied by somebody who's in the trenches trying to make decisions day to day. So I really wanted to bridge the gap between those two worlds of rigorous study and scrappy entrepreneurship into a guide that everybody can use Monday morning, but which also ties into very well thought through and well proven principles throughout business history.
And I think the most important thing we're talking about here is everybody's talking product, 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 service, service, service. But all those things are well and good. But if you don't have the market to place them in, you might as well give up before you even start. So this is really about the marketing process, isn't it?
Well, it's about defining a new space where you can compete as a company free from slogging it out with very entrenched competitors. It's not about trying to determine which established market is the best one to go after. Oftentimes, the best growth opportunities are invisible because they're not current markets, and they're also not things that present customers would even tell you about. You know, Henry Ford famously said about his industry, if I'd asked customers what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. So it's not intuitively obvious right in front of you. It's about really trying to understand what are those itches that need to be scratched, and then what are people going to adopt quickly if you do offer a way to scratch that itch.
Okay, so let me redefine what I was saying before, because the words in and of themselves can throw somebody off to a different definition. Not necessarily the market, but the marketplace, the place to offer your products, and that's where the growth opportunity is, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's not necessarily, as you say, defining your world very narrowly into building a better product or even creating a better service, but it's understanding the marketplace and the shifts that are occurring there. It's those discontinuities in the evolution of an industry that create opportunity for upstarts or even people who might be the number two or number three player in an industry. They can upend the established order quite quickly if there's fundamental changes in the marketplace. And we certainly know over the past 5 years we've seen a lot of that due to the Great Recession and globalization and innumerable other changes in the economy.
Now, by the way, when we look at as a new business, when we look at the marketplace today, obviously you've said it, and we'll say it in different words, it's changed based on circumstance, the economic circumstance, et cetera. But the marketplace is still the marketplace, and it's really the where to offer your goods and service, et cetera. And strategic thinking is critically important. You just can't walk into to sell swimming pools in the desert. It doesn't work that way. But where do you get that first step? Where is that first door that opens up that says, this is the place where the goods and the services will do the best?
Right. So that's a great question, Michael, because that's a question that a lot of people get wrong. The impetus, the impulse that people have is to go and after a big, well-defined, well-established market. Because that's what you would do in an established industry. You'd go after those biggest, most profitable customers. But in a new market, if you're going to do that, oftentimes those customers are going to be extremely demanding and take a very long time to sell into. So rather than go for what's very big but ultimately very slow moving, you want to go after very narrowly targeted segments of the marketplace that will adopt a solution quickly, give you learnings in terms of what the marketplace actually wants and how they're going to use your product or service, and then also provide a reference for customers who might be sitting on the fence wondering about whether they should jump in and purchase whatever that this new offering might be.
Now, by the way, one of the talking points that you have I think is critically important, because our biggest concern that's gone on in the last 15, 20 years is the difference between what we produce and sell as opposed to what we buy and we take in. We are not producing and selling, for the most part, anything in comparison. We've lost that competitive edge. But one of the talking points that you've got, and I think it's extremely important, is developing countries that are rich with profitable, untapped market opportunities. We could start to develop here. We could manufacture here. We can create here and go out to sell, and that would balance that imbalance that we have now.
Absolutely. For all the talk of globalization, even if you look at the S&P 500, sales to emerging markets are around 10% of revenues. So this is a relatively untapped opportunity to sell to 80% of the world's population. But a lot of companies have lost a bundle of money trying to do that. They try to export models that worked well in the United States and Europe, maybe in Japan, to emerging markets, and it just doesn't apply. So it's not just the product, although that usually does have to be reworked, but it's thinking about what sort of competencies your employees are going to need. How are you going to make money? It's probably going to be a lower gross profit, but if you can keep your expenses down, you might still have decent bottom line numbers, particularly if you look at the return on the capital you put in, because you may not have to put in a lot of capital expenditure in a developing country where labor is relatively inexpensive. So if you can step back and fundamentally rethink what is needed to succeed in those markets, then you stand a chance. The other thing that companies need to think about when they go to emerging markets is not just going after India and China. Certainly, they've got 40% of the world's population. They're very important places to be in the long run. But they're awfully hard places to do business. Looking at mid-sized markets that might be a little bit more receptive to foreign firms, like South Africa or Thailand or Colombia can be a much better way for a company that isn't very experienced in emerging markets to learn how it has to change business practices, and then it can move to the more difficult places.
All right, let's move on to something very interesting, because when it really comes down to it, that there's nothing really new. Everything is a derivative of something else, et cetera. So let's say you're the first one on the block with a particular product or service in a particular geographic area. How do you protect your hindsight? How do you protect yourself from the competitors so they won't catch up to you, so they won't overcome you and take what you created?
So there's a balancing act you have to perform here. Actually, when you're the first, competitors are your best friends, because competitors help you do the heavy lifting about educating the marketplace, getting customers off the fence, and reducing the risk that early customers might perceive about buying something that's new, because they have alternative people to go to. They won't necessarily be locked in to just one vendor. So competitors help you generate demand, and that is your real challenge. It's not beating competitors. It's getting demand going so that the rising tide lifts all boats. Now, as the market gets established, then the imperatives start to change, and you're going to need to compete a lot more effectively with companies who used to be your best friend. So in that case, it's important to think about, what are you proving to the marketplace? Where do you have scale? It might be in a really tiny sliver of the market, but for at least some set of customers, you are the biggest show in town. And because of that, you have a sustainable advantage against anybody else who might be trying to pile in once you've proven that this market is fairly attractive.
Now, by the way, when we take a look at the market, we make the market attractive, and then we create, and we get our positioning, we get our niche in that marketplace, everything is going fine. But there's going to become a time where we're going to have to develop more, because the society changes, the culture changes, the wants and needs and the desires of any country changes. So what about that innovation that has to come from within inside to be able to stay abreast of what the current wants are going to be?
You mean understanding how a marketplace is changing?
Yeah.
Well, sorry, go ahead.
And what to do to supplement?
Yeah, you're right. It is so tempting for companies that have had one or two successes to just focus on those core markets. And they get really good at pursuing those markets, but ultimately they can become irrelevant. You know, if you think back to digital equipment, they were a leader in the mini computer era, and they did really well by moving into companies that used to have mainframes and offering a cheaper, more accessible alternative. And then the personal computer came out, and digital responded by making better and better mini computers, but people just didn't care. And that happens in industry after industry. Kodak film is really good, but people aren't using film, so it doesn't matter that Kodak film is terribly good. So periodically, companies have to step back. They need to be passionate about their core business. Otherwise, their employees aren't going to be inspired. Their customers aren't going to be inspired. But yet they also have to be dispassionate in looking at their strategy, looking at their industry like an upstart might, and trying to say, okay, 5 years from now, how could somebody who comes from a totally different direction attack us and change the game? You know, the U.S. military does this. They have red teams who they put through an 18-week course to think like insurgents and try to find the weaknesses in U.S. military strategy. But big companies don't usually have a red team. They don't even have a red team exercise for a few years to rethink about the environment. And whether you're a big company or a small company, you need to step back and think about it. Ultimately, the marketplace doesn't care about you and your company. They just want to get the jobs done that they're trying to get done and buy the products that they want to buy. And there are always people looking at profitable markets trying to upend the order of things.
By the way, there's your next book, Stephen, The Red Team.
It's a good title. I might keep that.
It's yours. But when you really come down to it, what a great idea. You know, I wonder how many people think about the red team. It would do to really go out and find the most about yourself is to cut through to see where you're weak and where you need to be shored up. And I think that's a lot of companies, they don't know to do about it. They don't think about doing it, and that's why it takes strategic thinkers, people like yourself, to walk in, take a look at the things that normally companies are not looking at. And it's not that they won't look at, it's they don't know to look at. And I don't care how big the company is, it's always good when somebody comes in with a different set of eyes through a different prism to see what's going on in the daily operation. And that's when you find out what you can do to increase the value, the competitiveness, the competency, whatever the case may be, of that company.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know, that's a big reason I wrote the book. There aren't that many people whose job responsibility is to go out and create something totally new, unless they're an entrepreneur. But there's a lot of folks out there, whether they work in big or small companies, that need to look at their market with fresh eyes. And they need to do it in a way that doesn't require some kooky creativity lessons, but it is a very rigorous way to go about looking at markets while also be engaging and thinking about how does this relate to how companies over the past 200 years have tackled these challenges. So hopefully the book is a good list of things for people to think about, as well as a series of anecdotes about how that's played out.
You know, by the way, a prime example of that would be the media today, movies today. Every time you turn around, there's a vampire biting somebody, or somebody's running down the side of a wall, or there's a woman who takes on 50 men at one time and is combing her hair at the same time. And I really believe it's the same thing of changes in business. If you don't stay up with it, if you aren't able to move with the go with the flow, quote unquote, that there can be a tremendous amount of problems, and people really don't look that far ahead, and I really wish they would. Stephen Walker, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Sure thing. Well, the book website is Capturing New Markets, where there's a bunch of endorsement and also synopses of the different chapters. And then, of course, you can find the book on Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. It's available, of course, as a hardcover, as well as Kindle and a Nook book.
Wonderful. Hey, Stephen, thank you so much for spending the time with us. I really appreciated the time.
My pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Timothy Harlan with us. He's an MD, and he's the author of Just Tell Me What to Eat, the delicious six-week weight loss plan for the real world. As a matter of fact, he is a Dr. Gourmet, a.k.a. Dr. Gourmet. Radio Susie's over there throwing things at me. He's a medical director for the Tulane University School of Medicine and a chef, a professor, and an Emmy-winning television personality. And let us say, hi, Timothy. Welcome to the show.
It is great to be with you, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. And I fell over my mouth on Dr. Gourmet, so you get one on me during the interview, okay?
No problem.
Thanks. Now, by the way, somebody once said to me a long time ago, Timothy, they said, it's not what you don't eat that's going to cause you to lose weight. It's what you do eat. And I really believe when it comes down to it, we are nothing more than this massive electrochemical factory. And based on what we take in or what we don't take in is going to trigger those mechanisms within our body to say, store it or dump it. Am I close here?
I think you're pretty close. I think one of the challenges, though, for people today is there have been so many messages over the last 40 years about what they can and can't, low-fat, low-carb, fad diets, kind of silly diets that are just made up. And the nice thing is, over the last 10 or 12 years, the research that we have, evidence-based medicine that we have that says what really works for exactly what you're talking about, not just weight loss, because that's part of the dialogue, but also how healthy we are, we know what works now, and that's what this book is about.
Now, by the way, is that the bridge? Is that because we've got all of these diets everybody goes on, they go to this, and they hear about the carbs, they hear about this and that and whatever, and the next thing you know, they're not losing the weight they thought they would, and then they go start another program. Then they start another program, and there's nothing more than disappointment after disappointment after disappointment. Now, you being a chef also, besides being a medical doctor, you, besides talk the talk, you walk the walk, and you know what goes into the food. But what is that one ingredient of weight loss for you that you found that will cause success for people following what you have to say?
Well, I think flavor. Taste, great tasting recipes is right at the top of the list. At the end of the day, weight loss in and of itself, and that's part of this, part of what we're talking about, part of the dialogue, weight loss in and of itself is about calories. And so what I do with my recipes and with this diet plan in Just Tell Me What to Eat is create great tasting recipes that are not as calorie dense, but also based on Mediterranean diet principles, which we know are more filling, more satisfying, and a lot better for you.
Now, by the way, when we say that Mediterranean diet, and I've heard about this time and again for over a lot of years, what's the difference between a Mediterranean diet, and I know the question will probably, you can speak on it for 4 days, but the difference between a Mediterranean diet and an American diet?
Well, you're right, probably speak about it for 4 days because there's a tremendous amount of fantastic research about this now. So when I say Mediterranean diet, most people, it conjures up images of exotic food, Greek salad, hummus, dolmas, you know, all of these exotic Mediterranean dishes. But the fact of the matter is Mediterranean diet is really just a research term that has been coined when we studied the diets of those in Mediterranean countries. And it's 9 basic principles like more fruits and nuts, more vegetables, more legumes, more fish, less meat and lean meat, less dairy and more processed dairy like cheese and yogurt, better quality fats, alcohol in moderation, more vegetables, more cereals and grains. And those 9 principles is what I do is I translate that Mediterranean diet principles for the American kitchen so that you're not confused anymore.
Tim, we're going to, and I think we as a people, especially the American culture, we get all of these mixed media messages, and it's so confusing anymore that people just quit, and you've seen the obesity problem. And I think you've said it right. I think it's one of the first or second words that came out of your mouth. It's taste. If you can get them back into something feeling good, it tastes good when it goes down, all of a sudden it's night and day, it's a different story, and now there's value in it for me because I've seen so many people get off so many diets, they don't taste good, and they're forcing themselves to eat or they're forcing themselves not to eat, and the problem doesn't go away. You go into any supermarket and just sit there and watch the people walk up and down the aisles. That you can't put two of them side by side to get down most aisles.
that's why this, the very first day of this diet, and one of the things about just tell me what to eat is it doesn't start with 200 pages of dense pseudoscience or scientific knowledge that you have to attain to be able to do the plan. Starts off on day one, you read as you go, and the very first recipe on the very first day is fettuccine Alfredo. So, you know, these are how I translate. The day after that is a really terrific roasted salmon with a kind of southwestern corn relish. The recipes run the gamut. Some, you know, sort of exotic recipes that I'd like to have people get used to, but also Cajun cheeseburger, black and red fish, Philly cheesesteak, the types of things that you know and love and can eat. And they're designed in such a way to be really filling and really satisfying.
I think most importantly is the time it takes to make a lot of the food. You know, we're in that very fast-paced, quick-paced, microwavable world that everybody's is so much in a hurry that they don't even know what they're doing anymore. How can you fit that into the eating program during the day?
Well, you know, it's funny, Michael, when patients come to see me and I start having a discussion with them about lifestyle change and about diet, one of the first questions I ask them is, what are you doing next Tuesday at 2:30? And, you know, if I asked you that question, you'd probably pull out your iPhone or your BlackBerry or maybe your Day Runner. You'd check on your Outlook, and you'd say, oh, I've got this meeting. Well, what are you doing next Wednesday at 5:30? Oh, I've got to pick the kids up from soccer. We will plan every single moment of our lives, but the one thing that we fail to plan is for our health, and this is such an incredible part of our health, but also feeling better, having energy. It's about money because all of those, you know, quickie convenience meals, eating out at restaurants is extremely expensive. So what I want people to do, and it's addressed in the very, very early in the book, is setting those realistic goals and setting a plan for yourself. So that when I ask my patients, what are you having for dinner tonight, they can tell me. And if you can start that, that's the single most important step, is making that plan on Saturday so you know what you're having for dinner next Thursday. You know what you're taking for lunch next Wednesday. And you know, fast food and convenience food is not really fast food anymore. By the time you get in the car, drive over to the fast food joint, stand in line for 20 minutes or wait with your car idling for 20 minutes, pick up the food, maybe stay there and eat it and drive back, you've spent the amount of time that it would take for you to make a fantastic dinner for yourself and your family.
Now, by the way, go ahead and ask me what I'm doing next Wednesday at 3. Go ahead, ask me the question.
What are you doing next Wednesday at 3 o'clock?
I have no idea. Now, what is that?
You are the exception to the rule, my friend. You're the exception to the rule. Can you tell me what you're having for dinner tomorrow night?
Nah, but
well,
I'll tell you.
There.
Okay, no, I got you. But what I'm saying is, with the I don't know what I'm doing tells you one thing about me, my age.
Ah, that must be nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Who knows what I'm doing? I don't even know how to use a BlackBerry. But it is extremely important because, with all due respect and seriousness, that meals have to be planned, and more important, it's habit, repetition of action. You get into a habit, the habit becomes a lifestyle, and then the question really never comes up. You just automatically do it.
Exactly. And, you know, and I will tell you, as a physician, but also as a chef, I'm pretty realistic. I know that, you know, you have to pick up the kids on Tuesday night at 6:30 after soccer, and that's the night that you may want to use a convenience meal. And so those are built into the book. They're built into the plan that we review on the drgourmet.com website. We have a weekly email newsletter. We send out an email newsletter Monday through Friday, and our Friday newsletter is reviews of these very convenience foods that you're talking about. So we look for the ones that not only are better for you, they're going to be lower in sodium, they're going to have more fiber, they're going to be a reasonable amount of calories, but they've also been put to the tasting panel so that you know that they're going to taste better. And those are reasonable choices. There's restaurant choices in there as well. Common restaurants like Applebee's and P.F. Chang's and, you know, these types of restaurants where you can take your family on those days when you have to, you know, you just don't have time.
See, what I love about it, and I'm reading from the PR, the press release, which I think is extremely important. Just tell me what to eat. It includes shopping lists, nutrition tips, cooking techniques, a weekly meal plan, a daily meal plan, a food diary to make sure that the diets are easy to incorporate into everyday life. Now, let me tell you what this tells me, Tim. It tells me that you care. And that in and of itself could be one of the greatest selling points that you could ever have. We go through life and we care about anybody.
That's really nice, because this has been a mission of mine for the last 25 years. I wrote my first book about diet and nutrition when I was in medical school 25 years ago, and this really is kind of the culmination of all this. The neat thing about this book also is this fully interfaces with our online software at Dr. Gourmet. So we have really one of the only family-friendly menu planners on the internet. It's completely free, doesn't cost people anything. You go, you build profiles for yourself, your husband, your kids, your spouse, and then you build your group for your family, and it will create 2-week menu plans complete with shopping lists. And, as I said a minute ago, it's got those convenience meal options in there, and it also has the options for these menus from the book to create shopping lists for your family. It's one thing for me to put a shopping list in the book that has all of the ingredients you need. It's another thing for me to have that software to be able to say, all right, you're going to need 6 servings of this. You actually are going to have to make 2 of these recipes, which means we need to multiply that out for you and create the shopping list.
I think that's critically important, because there's so many people today. Number one is, if they had to do that themselves, strategically, they probably couldn't do it. With all due respect to everybody out there, everybody's so involved in what they're doing every day, they just can't stop and take time to do something. So for the most part, you're thinking for them too, which is a good thing in that particular area. Not telling them how to live their life, but thinking along the lines of being supportive and helping them at the same time. That in and of itself is critical also. Most people need to be held by the hand so you can bring us to where we need to be to get the job done.
Well, and every bit of this book grows out of that that clinical practice that I have every day. And interestingly, the name of the book comes from a patient who was one of the genesis of these menu plans that I started creating about 8 or 10 years ago, where she came into the office and she's a young woman, brand new family. She had a little girl and a husband, and she was a stay-at-home mom, and she said, just tell me what to eat. And, you know, I started kind of with my shtick, oh, you want more whole grains and this and that, and she said, no, just tell me what to eat. And it took her, she had to say it 3 times before I realized, oh, she wants me to create menus from my recipes to help her with her weekly planning. And I think that some of that has been lost. So it has its genesis in that very foundation of what you're discussing.
And also, the food that we put into our bodies is going to help us or hurt us one way or the other. So really what I'm seeing here is if you are that successful as Dr. Gourmet, as a medical doctor, you're going to run yourself out of business, because they're not going to be sick anymore.
Well, you know, I think that our healthcare system is a little challenged right now, and one of our challenges is that we don't, work on preventative medicine like we should. And I don't mean that as individuals, because a lot of my colleagues, myself, I think, do take these kinds of steps. But our healthcare system really right now is set up to treat disease more than prevent disease. And you're right, I would love nothing more than to put myself out of business. That'd be fantastic.
But when you think about it, it's what you eat. If I follow what you have to say here, if I go to the website, if I get into the software, if I buy the book, and I'm doing this, then I'm not going to be loaded with cholesterol. I'm not going to be loaded with fat. I'm not going to be loaded with heart problems. This list goes on. So that's really when I said that.
Well, and you know, I have obviously dozens and dozens of examples. I had a patient come in last week, and this is about slow, sustained, long-term, successful, sustainable weight loss. This is not about the idea of 20 pounds in 10 days is a very sexy message, and it's one of the messages that I think people do get kind of roped into, you know, and it is a challenging message sometimes for Dr. Gourmet, for me to say to people, this is about 20 pounds in 26 weeks, this is about a pound a week. But when you do that, when you lose that kind of weight, even if it's 12 pounds in a year, I had a patient come in the other day. He probably needs to lose about 35 pounds a year ago. He's lost about 13 of that, but the result for him has been that he is now off of his diabetes medication. He's on half as much blood pressure medication. We've avoided putting him on medication for cholesterol. And I know because of things that he said to me, how he's embraced this. Things like, I'm saving money because my pantry is now stocked right. We talked about that a minute ago. But I know a year from now he'll be off all of his blood pressure medication, and this is really common.
And by the way, and I think it's absolutely wonderful, but at the same time, it's finding the right people, the right books, the right programs, and that's why I think you're doing a really good job as far as going out and getting into the media and talking about it, and somebody will tell somebody will tell somebody, because that's the really one of the only ways that we really get some decent-sized exposure.
Well, and again, it's guys like yourself who will take the risk to have someone on with that, you know, sensible, sustainable message. I think it is challenging, but as I said, I've been at this 25 years and have no intentions of giving up anytime soon.
Now I hear you loud and clear. Hey, Tim, we're just about out of time. Is there a website we can find you at, the book and the rest of it?
It is very simple. It's drgourmet.com. That's drgourmet.com. But the book is also available in bookstores nationwide right now, as well as at amazon.com and barnesandnoble.com.
Hey, great. Tim Harlan, thank you so much for joining me. And again, the book is Just Tell Me What to Eat. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Bye-bye. For you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Kevin Rainier with us. He is the author of In Search of Fatherhood, A Motherload of Wisdom from the World of Daughterhood. He received a social science degree from the University of California, Santa Cruz, before beginning his career as a business journalist. Later, he completed an MBA at the University of California, Berkeley, where he lived with 600 women and men from around the world in the International House. And with a marketing career, his marketing career has taken him through fast growth startups, successful global companies, and business impositions. Now, his interest in a cross-cultural perspective evolved as his career presented opportunities to work throughout Europe and Asia. He's the founder and the president of B2B Market Strategies, and he divides his time among his family, writing, and his work as a marketing and brand strategist to emerging companies. And let us say, Kevin, I welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
And by the way, thank you so much for being here. Let me ask you this, but before we go any farther, obviously you came to this point in your life, you had to make some decisions. Define what a father is.
Well, that's a great question, and nobody's asked it of me in the weeks that I've been on tour here. But, you know, I would say that it's somebody who really understands that it's a much bigger role than just the biological role of parenting, and that there's a psychological component of real commitment to the really establishing the foundation for a daughter's or a son's life, and that the commitment is enormous, particularly during the first 8 or 10 years, but certainly over the course of a son or daughter's lifetime.
When we really come down to it, and most people today, I think the biggest problem that they have, Kevin, is defining what a father is. You know, you go out and you work, you do everything you can possibly do to raise your children and provide for them and have the most. And at the same time, there's so many people who miss the kids themselves. They miss the whole idea of having a kid. So it's got to be a very interesting fence to walk, so to speak, because if you provide and provide and provide and you let them go, they don't know what it's like to have a father. So there's that element that ends up lacking.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there is no single definition, right, of what constitutes a father. I mean, if you go to different cultures around the world or different periods of history, the whole notion shifts and evolves and ebbs and flows. But there's one thing that I think we could all agree on that is common, and that is, particularly when it comes to daughters, fathers get no training, instruction, or coaching anywhere in their development.
True.
And, you know, you and I and every other dad in the world has learned probably 101 different things over the course of our lifetimes, from math to reading to playing baseball or, you know, how to manage a business when we got older. But there is never anything in your lifetime that really grounds you or trains you in being a father to a daughter.
Somebody once asked me what the difference between, between a man and a woman was. And I got the answer to that on a show that was done sometime in the last 5, 10 years, whatever the case was. And I remember the question came up and the response from the guest was lap time. In the formative years, the girls are held on mom's lap. They're held, they're cuddled, they're kissed, they're talked to. The boys don't get that. Now, I'm not saying that they should get that or shouldn't get that, but there's that difference between the two, the intimacy that you and I as men didn't receive going through those formulative years that the girls got. And who says it's right, wrong, or indifferent, but I think that's a key. And I think today's world, and especially in today's world, we're beginning to level some of that out.
Yeah, thankfully we are. You know, I heard some really remarkable stories in the course of putting my book together. You know, I interviewed over the course of a year 50 women from around the world, and we went really into depth on their life stories and how they were shaped by their fathers. And one of the really remarkable things, which really surprised me, was how many spectacular fathers there were and there are out there. And some of these women recalled these very, very young memories of, like, having their fathers hold them on their chest as they would both fall asleep. And the little girl would be 1.5, 2.5 years old, something like that. And so thankfully, there are those examples and there are those stories. And part of what I wanted to do with this book is take some of those stories of spectacular fatherhood and put them into that story format and take them out into the world.
Yeah, and by the way, fatherhood in and of itself, the definition of that has also changed over the years, too. As women came more into their own, into the marketplace, then they got into the business in the corporate world and owning their own businesses. More and more today, you're finding more stay-at-home dads, guys that are taking that responsibility on, and the shift whether anybody likes it or not, the shift is there. And the most important thing is to be able to handle that shift and deal with it in such a way that it benefits everybody in the family.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it certainly can benefit everyone indeed in the family and certainly the kids. I have a number of very close friends whose wives are the breadwinners in their families, and the dads have stayed home for years and have raised the kids. And it's really remarkable. You know, it's not that the mother loses the qualities that she might have with the kids if she's a, you know, nurturing, affectionate woman to begin with or any of that. But the bond that it forms with their fathers is really strong and will be enduring over the course of their lifetimes.
No question about it. But again, how do you develop that balance when dad's out, dad's working, dad's got to maintain that level of income so everybody at least has got food on the table and a roof over their head? And there is a tremendous amount of circumstances today where guys just can't get home and do what you're talking about doing.
Yeah, you know, I felt those pressures for years. And I can absolutely empathize with anybody who is going through that right now. You know, I was the sole breadwinner for a family, and I know what it's like to feel like you've got to be at work. And it's not a binary kind of thing where if you have a, you know, significant responsibility, you can say to your boss or the president of the company, look, I've got time for 80% of this job. It's either you can do the job or you can't. And so, you know, the thing that I've responded with when people have asked me that question, either fathers individually or on interviews, I say, well, first of all, you know, determine if there is any flexibility or if you can bring some flexibility to your career. Because culturally, we have this really, this really unfortunate norm whereby the career ascension that we're supposed to be on happens during the same years that our kids are young, right? We're in our 30s and, you know, trying to get our careers established in our 40s, and with parents having kids later now, those are really the key years that your kids need you there. And that was part of the reason that I left the corporate world, and I just wanted to spend more time with my kids. So I'd say, one, if you can somehow finesse the flexibility in your career, that's absolutely helpful. I think the second thing is, even if you can't do that, one of the remarkable lessons I learned from these women, and they spanned 7 decades from their 20s through their 80s, and again, they were from 20 countries around the world, is that small things make the big difference. And it's not that dads need to do something Herculean and monumental to be remembered. Dads that did these small things, like a woman named Denise, her dad had a second job on Saturday. So the guy worked 6 days a week, but he took her out on the garbage truck, on his garbage route on Saturdays, and she got the biggest kick out of riding in the truck. And then on Saturday nights, he would take her to the demolition derbies. And she just had that one-on-one time with dad. So even if you've got to be working long hours, you know, find ways to pull your daughter in on the things that you like to do, and see if there are ways to bring her into your work life in any small way. And just recognize that there are so many small things that will make a big difference in her life.
You know, by the way, very interesting, and it's part of the talking points from your press release as I'm listening to you. The book, from what I gather, is almost a boot camp for dad. A boot camp for dad to say, this is what you're looking at when you're dealing with the other side of the issue, you know, coming from the daughter's side, the rest of it. But let's say dad does that. Let's say dad spends 20-30% of his time at home or around the kids now. It's also the daughters. The daughters in and of themselves have got to be, and I'm going to have to say the word trained to be able to talk to their dad, to be able to open dad up. Dad can get out there and spend as much time as he wants with the kids, but if those kids don't know how to bring the most that they can out of dad, find out those things that they're dying to ask but are afraid to, a lot of it's wasted time.
Yeah, I think, well, certainly as the kids get older and then into adulthood, I think it's incumbent upon the children as they get into young adulthood and middle adulthood to really work to establish that relationship. But I really believe the onus is on the fathers, particularly when your kids are young, that, you know, the fathers have the responsibility to step up as fathers. And they're not all equipped. We're not all equipped, and I've spent decades of my life in that situation, and thankfully I'm moving farther and farther along the continuum. But, you know, as dads, we're not well trained. Again, we're not well instructed in how to do this. One of the
kind of fun and creative tools that I put together is now posted on YouTube if anybody's interested in seeing a very short video there. But it's kind of a quick, it's a five-minute instructional thing for dads on what every daughter is looking for from her father. And it's written, it's a letter that's written from the vantage point of a newborn daughter. And it includes in this letter, again, and I have a number of girls and then women, from really young girls to the last reader is a woman in her 80s, reading sections of the letter. But it's all these key lessons that, or many of them that I learned along the way that could be really instructive for dads. And they're captured in this video. I really think during your kids' childhoods, the onus of responsibility is on the parents. And then as that relationship hopefully moves and evolves more and more to a peer relationship when you're in adulthood, that there's more equity in the responsibility.
You know, I love the idea of the letter to dad, you know, broken up, almost you could call the women a focus group, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. Say it again.
Okay, the women would be almost like a focus group. If you get enough women that would help create a letter to dad, then you've got it. Yeah, from all different areas. Yeah, and that in and of itself, the focus group is one of the most potent and important things that you could possibly do, because you're going to get overarching themes of what they wanted for dad, and that will work with 90% of daughters to fathers across the world.
Yeah, yeah.
Because how do you know?
That's somewhat what the whole book was, you know. I again, with 50 women over the course of a year, it's almost like, you know, it's almost like being behind that one-way mirror as you read the book, that one-way mirror in the focus group room. These women were just extraordinarily open and emotionally available with their life stories. They certainly knew they were being used. I mean, I had a recorder right there, and they had signed a consent form and everything like that. But just being let in to those very intimate parts of their lives and their memories and their longing for what they didn't get and the regrets around that or the cherished memories of what they did get. So it's almost like a collection of 50, you know, miniature focus groups.
Yeah, by the way, have you gotten response from dads? I mean, you know, you get them from the women, but what about the dads? What about the response from the dads? How many of them that read it, that fed you back, that said, I didn't see it, I never saw it?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I literally, about 10 minutes before our call started, I just got back from Seattle where I did a TV appearance, and I jumped in to look at a few emails, and I got an email from the CEO of a large health system I used to work for, and he retired about 5 years ago, and he came across my work. People had fed him different pieces of it, and there was some, you know, media coverage of it that he read, and he was effusive in his thanks for my having done that work. It really touched me and surprised me. But I get a lot of feedback from dads. It's really remarkable.
Is it because when it comes down to it, there are people who will say, and I've heard it many, many times over the years, you know, what's your target market, you know, for whatever the subject matter is? And very interesting in with you, Kevin, your target market is everybody, because somebody is going to be a dad or will be a son or a daughter or will be a mom or whatever. So realistically, the message is there for everybody.
And it really is. This is a really, you know, you could consider it in terms of the book genres. It's in more of a popular psychology offering. But my target market is, in its essence, you know, like 90% of my market, I believe, will be women over 40 and men under 40. And it's the women over 40 who are at a period in their lives where, you know, they're beginning to get more reflective and there's more meaning that they're starting to see in their relationship with their fathers. And that, you know, the 40 is not a hard and fast line, of course. It's just my kind of back of the napkin description. But it's, you know, women at midlife where they're really starting to contemplate more about who they are, the relationship with their mothers and fathers. And then when I say men under 40, I think, you know, a lot of men are interested in this kind of thing who have young kids, and particularly young daughters. So those are my primary and secondary markets, respectively. And, you know, there will certainly be older men and younger women who look at it, but those are the two principal markets for this book.
Oh, sure. But again, everybody, the nucleus is everybody is either a mom, a dad, a son, or a daughter. And that's not like a percentage of people. Everybody falls into that. And if there's a guy out there who's not a dad, they're going to have to relate back to the relationship with their dad. Because, yes, you keyed into daughters, but everything I'm hearing is the same thing with a son, too.
Yeah. That's true. As one of my friends and colleagues said, you know, when it comes to fathers, everyone has one, is one, or knows one.
Yeah. No, absolutely. There's no question about it. And I really believe that when it comes down to it, the quote-unquote, the things that you're discussing, the things that I'm looking at from the press release, you got it spot on. I mean, it's really there, and especially in today's world. In today's world, with what is going on, the 50-some-odd% divorce rate, the never knowing what's going to go on next, and it's global at this point, and it's not just what's happening in your community, it's very scary, and families are starting to pull apart. And if this can be the glue to get some of them to stick together, then, you know, so be it, and great. But for the window of opportunity, I think the book is spot on right now.
Yeah, well, thanks very much. That's a big part of my hope for the book.
No, no question about it. Okay, let me ask you this. I picked that book up, and I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get that I did not have before I read this book?
Sure. I think if there's an overarching takeaway, it's this, that around the world, and it's universal, it's across cultures, it's across generations through history. The father-daughter story is a very tender love story. That's the nature of it to begin with. That's how we're wired as humans. And one of three things happens with that love story, and this is how I organize the book and write about it. The first of those three things is that the daughter gets what I call the long straw in her father. And these are the wonderful, attentive, affectionate fathers that we would wish for ourselves, for our kids, and for the entire world. And, of course, there's the other end of the continuum that I call the short straw, where women are getting really terrible fathering. They're abandoned by their fathers. They're discarded. They are abused emotionally, physically, or sexually. And, these are utterly tragic stories, and, you know, the third section of my book goes into some of those in detail. And in the middle, there's this section that I call the long and the short of it. It's almost like it's sort of a green light, red light, and a yellow light. And the long and the short of it is about fathers who are there physically but really not there emotionally. Or there are other ways for this sort of middle ground of the long and the short of it. But anyway, that's how I organize the book, and the stories tend to fall very naturally into that. So I think the key takeaway, if there's a single one from the work that I did, was that, you know, everything you do as a father is communicating to your daughters and your sons as well. And that what you need to think about, or what I hope people will think about, is that they're giving daily a long straw, a short straw, or something in between to their kids, and to be aware of that. And to try to make a conscious effort to give them the longest straw possible. And you do that through every day's events that are either dramatic or just very subtle. But as a father, it's like laying down a coat of varnish every day. You know, everything that you do communicates something.
Yeah, what you say does, and what you don't say does, cause and effect, no matter which way you look at it. Kevin, we're about out of time. Website, we can find you and find the book.
Yeah, thanks very much. So, again, the website is kevin-renner.com. I mentioned the YouTube video, so if you go to YouTube and just type in Kevin Renner, I think the kind of keys for fathers will show up, but it's also really resonated with daughters, and people can follow me on Facebook as well.
Wonderful. Hey, Kevin, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you for having me on the show.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Luann Lofton with us. She's the author of Warren Buffett Invests Like a Girl and Why You Should Too. Luann Lofton is proudly investing just like a girl since she was a girl. And after losing her father at age 14, she resolved to take control of her own financial future and become obsessed with learning how to invest. Her quest led her to Warren Buffett in 1994 and The Motley Fool in 2000, where she rose to the position of managing editor of Fool.com, an award-winning financial education website visited by more than 5 million visitors each month. Warren Buffett Invest Like a Girl is her first book and the one that allowed her to finally meet her investment idol. And let us say, Luann, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. What's it like to invest like a girl? Is there any difference between the way you and I would do it?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that studies and research show that men and women do tend to invest very differently. Men tend to trade more. They tend to view investing more as a gamble or as a game. They tend to be more overconfident, which can lead them to make mistakes. It can lead them to buy companies that they don't fully understand. And women just tend to be a little more patient, a little more long-term focused, a little more prudent. All characteristics that you'll find when you look at, you know, that guy out in Omaha, Warren Buffett.
Yeah. Now, by the way, when we really deal with this, and I'm listening very closely to what you said, there's more of what you're saying is in general now. There, as a woman, you would invest a little more cautiously. You'd sit back and look at it and maybe look deeper into the possible consequence than a guy would, because we're going to get in there, we're going to do it, we're going to make a bunch of money, and if we don't, we'll complain about it, go get some more, and dump it back in. are we close here?
Yes, that is. That's actually pretty close, I would say. Yeah, you know, what you find when you look at kind of research on all this stuff, it's really fascinating, and it does show that women tend to be less confident in their abilities when it comes to investing, and they tend to be more risk averse. Now, these can sound like bad qualities. You know, you think, why would I want to be less confident and scared to take risk? But they can end up working in women's favor, because what it can do is actually make women, on average, tend to do more research to compensate for this feeling of, oh gosh, I'm not quite sure what I'm doing. And then not taking as much risk, not trading as much, and kind of going all gung-ho on a hot stock tip or something. That does tend to be something you see with male investors, is this sense of overconfidence of, I know everything. And like you said, I'm going to get in there and take action.
Yeah. I guess we have to ask, and it's a rhetorical question, is it confidence or is it arrogance? And I think there's a difference between the two. And the arrogance is what costs you money and costs a lot of problems. Confidence is really making sure of what you're doing more than anything else. I can be confident in my decision, but if I haven't researched it, if I haven't done all the necessary things to do to make sure that my decision is going to be the best that I can get out of whatever it is, then that's not confidence at all. That's just arrogance, and it hurts people.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the key really is overconfidence. I mean, that's the word that tends to just come up again and again. is that men tend to be overconfident. And, they tend to just take shortcuts, basically, when it comes to investing, instead of doing thorough research, instead of asking tough questions. And you couple that with taking more risk and trading more, and you can see how that can lead to some troubling outcomes.
Well, let's go back and take a look at what happened with the housing market and all the leveraging that happened. And I mean, we can go on and on with that. Most people know anyway. I don't want to belabor it. But at the same time, there was a greed that went on that it's very hard to control. And I think that greed goes along with the overconfidence and the arrogance. I think that keys it, because now we don't want to look like we're wrong, so we're going to do everything we can do to make us look good, even if anybody gets hurt with this. And I think that is an element that we have to look at also.
Yes. Yeah, I would completely agree with that. This kind of drive to just do something. And then, if you're in trouble, then you just try to fix it. You try to, find a solution for it. And you're exactly right. When you look at what happened with the housing bubble, and when you look at what happened with the markets in 2008 and 2009, you saw a lot of this kind of overconfidence leading, and put that also with short-term decision-making. You're not thinking of the long-term consequences of your actions. That can get us to some pretty scary places.
I think the other side of that, too, is that not in today's world, but in a world that I grew up, and I didn't get involved in it, but there was a draft in those days, and kids went to the military. I happened to have joined way back 300 years ago, but you're taught to make, maybe 250, I don't want to go. But you're taught to make very rapid decisions, very quickly, life or death decisions. And I think that in and of itself carries on. John Wayne still lives. I don't care what anybody says. And it's that, what do you got to do? What do you got to say? It's got to happen now. And that's that element that a lot of women don't have. It's not inherent. It's that kind of be mom, sit back, take a look at it, take a step forward, and whatever. And what I have found over these years, 210 years, okay. What I found over these years is that for the most part, it takes a combination of the two to be successful. You can be overconfident, but at the same time, you can be overcautious.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I would definitely say that something in researching books, some of the courage women do is, take a page from men in this case and actually become an investor. You have to take steps. You have to take action there. Don't go too far with it and become a, frantic day trader out there. But you do have to, you're exactly right, you have to be able to combine the two things. And more women, frankly, should be investing. I think that would be a better thing for us all, actually for their portfolios, but then for the world at large as well.
Yeah, Luann, what I absolutely love, we've heard for years that women don't have the power, they don't have the decision-making ability, yada, yada. I mean, you can go on for 3 hours of what women aren't supposed to have. But any time there is a decision to be made, the man is sitting there. And you're saying, okay, here it is. You know what's coming up next. He's about ready to make the decision. And what does he say? I have to ask my wife. So tell me where the power really lies.
That is very funny. I mean, that's something that I hope we will spur some of the investing side of that with this book. I mean, women absolutely are involved in making decisions about how families spend their money, about how they allocate their resources. I think there's a further step that could be made where, a man starts asking his wife about investing and getting her involved in those decisions. And it's critical that women become involved in these decisions. We know that women make less over their working lives, and they live longer than men, so they're having to make do with less money. And like you said in your intro about me, it's not an exact, an exact same situation, obviously, but I had at a pretty early age to figure out how to handle some money on my own. And a lot of women are going to face this later in life, and it's better, I would say, to educate yourself like I did and, become empowered, because you do have it within you to be a great investor. I mean, this is a wonderful story.
Oh, well, no question. I think the thing that at base, what men and women have together is we're both human beings, and we're both, from the planet Earth, some of us anyway. But the point of contention really is this, is that we have the ability. And in today's world, the definition of a woman today is not the definition that it was 20, 30, 35 years ago. It's different. It's the society, the culture. If I use those two words in every show, it's important that we stay up with the norm of what's going on. And women today are not defined as women were. Women are in the corporate world. Women are controlling businesses. Women are doing all of these things. And I think the biggest problem that we had years back, the definition of a man was the guy handles the money and the woman takes care of the kids and you know the story. But the problem with that is we grew out of that. But because we grew out of that, no one took the time to say to women, learn what a checkbook is. Learn what a credit card is. And a lot of them had to go out and make mistakes. They learned and they became successful at what they were doing. But there's that point where you got to be taught. Spending money and finances are not something that comes naturally to people. This is an acquired skill.
Yeah, absolutely. You definitely have to do some work. You know, you have to do a lot of reading. You have to educate yourself. And, you know, that's certainly what we hope will happen with this book, is that women will see that, hey, wow, maybe I am naturally suited with this temperament that leads me to be a great long-term investor. Like Warren Buffett, the greatest investor the world's ever seen. You know,
like we talked about earlier,
being patient, being calm, and they'll be inspired inspired and empowered to take this on, to learn. Because you're right, it's not easy. It is going to take some work. No. We all know that, but it's worthwhile. It's so worthwhile.
Well, sure, but Luann, what was Buffett's secret? What was it, if you could just take one thing away and say, this is what he did, and this is what allowed him to be successful?
I think the thing that would stand out to me about Buffett in that sense would just be, he's not afraid to go his own way. You know, you see that in the fact that he lives in Omaha, not in New York, not in Manhattan. And he's been out there for forever. And he doesn't feel this drive to take action. To him, investing is very thoughtful. You are literally putting your money into a company, into a living company, not a ticker symbol, not something flashing on a screen. And he takes that so seriously. And I think that has just, you know, he's turned that into something where he literally just goes his own way. He doesn't feel any pressure from Wall Street or from anyone else, frankly, to do anything he doesn't think is smart or anything that he doesn't want to do.
Now, by the way, if women didn't have the ability and the capability that you're talking about, we would not have women in politics today. We wouldn't have women running for president, women running for vice president, women that have congressional seats, and I mean the list goes on. So it's a completely different world out there. But one of the things that has to happen, man or woman, it really doesn't matter, that if you're going to get out into the world, if you're going to get out and compete in this marketplace that we have to whatever end result, you better know what you're doing before you get out there, and you better have that that savvy behind you. Some of it you're going to get academically, but most of it is street smarts. You're going to have to go fall down a few times, combine it all together, and that's where it comes.
And, absolutely. Yeah, and you have to be able to learn from your mistakes. We're all going to make them. Investing isn't perfect. Buffett makes mistakes, you know, and he writes about them every year in his annual shareholders letter. You can learn about the mistakes that he made in the past year, and he always has his kind of funny take on them. But you're exactly right. You've got to give it a go. You've got to try. And you've got to learn how to really become an investor. I mean, one thing that's interesting, I would say, you know, we can't all be like Buffett in the sense that he's obviously just brilliant. He just consumes information. He retains information. And he's just kind of a mind unlike any other. However, what this book touches on really is the idea of temperament, which can help you become a great long-term investor. You can control your emotions, and that's something that we can all learn. You know, I can't teach you how to become as smart as Warren Buffett. I'm certainly not at all, but we can all improve our investing temperaments, and that will help you over the long term.
Well, you just said something interesting, and not necessarily Buffett's smarts. Anybody can become as smart as Buffett. But what you can't learn, and you just said it, is his temperament. That's what brings him above the rest of the crowd. He knows when to back off. He knows when to get aggressive. And he makes the choice.
Yes, exactly. And he's often doing the exact opposite of what everyone else is doing. I mean, in the book, we really lay out 8 principles that people can learn to adopt for themselves. And they're things just, trade less, try to rein in your overconfidence, like we talked about earlier, take less risk, do more research, ask hard questions. And these are all things that can just set you up to have a great mindset and an ability to control your emotions, because that is the thing that's key. You can be the smartest investor in the world. You can know all the right formulas. You can know all the numbers and this and that. But you can actually get yourself into a lot of trouble if you cannot control your emotions. If you panic, you sell at the wrong time. It's interesting. One study I cite in the book is from Vanguard, and they looked at almost 3 million of their IRA accounts in the fall of 2008. And you remember what that was like. It was a pretty scary time. And they found that women were more likely than men to hold through thick and thin. Men were more likely to sell at the bottom. They let their emotions get the better of them, and they panicked and they sold, which undoubtedly locked in big losses and then made them miss the market's upswing when it eventually turned the other way. That stuff like that just kills you as an investor. You have to be able to get control of your emotions.
You want to feel better about the market. Did you see Wall Street 2?
I have not seen it yet. I have to be honest.
You got to see it.
Okay, I will.
I mean, you literally got it. By the way, they did a wonderful job in the movie, and it was good. And Michael Douglas was better than he was, and he was Gecko all the way across the. But you got to watch the movie. The movie is absolutely wonderful, and it's all about investment, obviously. But it's all about everything that you just talked about. If you look, I just saw it 2-3 nights ago. That's why it's fresh. The emotion, what causes what to happen, the anger, the rest of it, and the suppressed stuff. All of the things that you're saying are incorporated into the decision making process when somebody is going to do something: invest, don't invest, hold back, know when to do it. And I think that's a great example. If you know what you're watching, it's a great example of what goes on in the world today.
Yeah, I will definitely. I will have to take a look. I mean, I'm sure it sounds like it's a pretty good illustration for a lot of the stuff I talk about in the book. One thing that you just reminded me of there was testosterone. I mean, we were talking about overconfidence earlier, and we have to talk a little bit about testosterone and the role it plays. We can't blame all the booms and busts on testosterone, obviously, but there's some really interesting research that's come out about the role of testosterone when you have these trading floors and these financial firms filled, in many cases, primarily with men. And when you get groups of men around one another, environment really can influence your testosterone levels. You become more competitive against the other men. Also, you take more risks. If we had a couple more women sprinkled into some of those situations, I would argue that we would not have these kind of severe booms and busts, because they would actually help kind of tamp down the emotions in that room.
No, by the way, and there's not only testosterone, there's also dopamine, there's also all of these different chemicals that go. And you're absolutely right. It does create it, and it does create the competitive edge. But with that, we're about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, sure. Well, the book goes on sale tomorrow, so you can check it out on Amazon.com. And then we have a site set up at fool.com/girl. And then if you go to Facebook and type in Warren Buffett Invest Like a Girl, we have a page there, too, where we have lots of fun stuff. We have a contest going on right now, and you can win some fun prizes from the Motley Fool.
Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time, and I'm going to be very careful not to overdo the testosterone when I invest.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I had a great time.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Way. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Stuart Kaplan with us. He is the author of Your Child Does Not Have Bipolar Disorder, How Bad Science and Good Public Relations Created the Diagnosis. He's the director, was the director of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the Long Island Jewish Hillside Medical Center, executive director of Rockland's Child Psychiatric Center, director of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at St. Louis University, and the Director of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Director of Child Psychiatry Residency Training at the Penn State College of Medicine. From 1996 to 2005, he was the principal investigator and co-principal investigator of 41 pharmaceutical industry-funded child psychiatric clinical trials. All of the proceeds of these trials went to the universities employing Dr. Kaplan, and he served on the editorial board of the Journal of American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. And this list goes on. And I'm telling you what, Stuart, what do you do in your spare time?
Hi, Michael. Good evening. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, thank you. And by the way, when we talk about, in the subject matter, ADD today, I am wondering how many medical doctors actually are aware of what ADD is, because symptomatically it may say ADD, but there's so many other things that it could be, and the misdiagnosis, the wrong diagnosis, I'm going to give you a probably because I'm not a clinician, probably happens time and time and time again, and that kid that doesn't have the ADD that gets treated for it gets stuck with the underlying problem for the rest of their life.
Well, that is a terrible possibility, and you know, in those situations where it's true, it's really tragic. However, I take a somewhat different tact in my book, Your Child Does Not Have Bipolar Disorder. That my concern is that the children who were incorrectly diagnosed with bipolar disorder, up to 80 to 90% of them actually have ADHD. They actually have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And attention hyperactivity disorder is treated with relative ease and relative safety. Children with ADHD are treated with stimulant medications. 80% of them really dramatically improve, if not 100% different children than they were before the medicine was given. So the treatment of ADHD is, by and large, highly effective and highly safe. And although many people take the tact that you're taking, that ADHD is overdiagnosed, the reality is that if you take a careful look at the scientific literature, that most of the studies of this, epidemiological studies, really support the notion that it's underdiagnosed rather than over-diagnosed. So that sometimes you see alarming headlines in newspapers or the notion of freight cars trundling through the night filled to the top with Ritalin and so forth. That these are somewhat alarmist visions. It's true that the number of children treated has gone up, but the number of treated children does not reach the estimates of the number of children who actually have the diagnosis. So I think this is an important part of my book. I actually spend a fair amount of time on ADHD and stimulant medication. And I strongly believe, and the science supports me, there's over 3,000 studies of stimulant medication in ADHD. And these studies repeatedly demonstrate time and time again that the treatment, particularly in the short term, is highly effective and highly safe. So in comparison to treating a child for a disorder that they don't have, which would be bipolar disorder, and the children with bipolar disorder are often treated or almost always treated with very dangerous medications that are used to treat adults who actually have bipolar disorder. The children don't have bipolar disorder, and they're given a variety of medications that are associated with lethal side effects and often very undesirable long-term side effects. So from a risk-benefit ratio, I would much prefer to correctly diagnose a child with ADHD and treat them with stimulant medication or even educational interventions rather than diagnose them with a disorder they don't have, bipolar disorder, and give them dangerous medications that are used for adults with bipolar disorder.
Well, so let me ask you
this. This is one of the themes of my book. So that's why I wanted to challenge what you said in the beginning.
Oh, that's fair. I'm not a clinician, and then the challenge is I take it gracefully, and I appreciate that your knowledge behind it. Now, let me ask you this: bipolar. Moving to that, when we're dealing with bipolar, what are some of the symptoms that we look for? What are we looking at in the kids that would be an indication that this is what we're dealing with?
Well, I think call your attention to my title, Your Child Does Not Have Bipolar Disorder. So a variety of symptoms that children can present with are misattributed to bipolar disorder. I think the primary symptom that is attributed to bipolar disorder is aggression, anger, irritability. These children are often chronically aggressive, chronically irritable, fretful, often defiant, often opposition. And again, around 80% of them correctly carry a diagnosis of ADHD. So they're often hyperactive and, you know, having trouble in school and not listening and intruding on other people and so forth. So these kinds of symptoms have led clinicians to frequently make an incorrect diagnosis of bipolar disorder. Before 1995, bipolar disorder in children was virtually an unknown diagnosis. It was rarely, if ever, made and never seen. And this, my book is about the creation of this diagnosis, how it was developed, how it was propagated, and how it was sold to the American public, the consumers, as well as the professionals, child psychiatrists and other professionals who deal with mental health in children, you know, bought into the diagnosis, accepted it, and helped propagate it and treat it, much to the detriment of everybody involved.
Now, by the way, was there any reason behind this? What was the impetus for the misdiagnosis? Was it the pharmaceutical industry where somebody had to benefit from the diagnosis? Stuart, I'm sorry I have to say that, but when we take a look at what goes on today, this is what we're finding. If you follow the money trail, sometimes you can find what causes the problems that we face, and then there's no way to fix them.
The pharmaceutical industry definitely benefited from the diagnosis, and they were pleased to exploit the diagnosis as another opportunity to market their medications, and they were supportive of it. But the diagnosis did not originate with them, although they were happy to go along with the development of the diagnosis. The the origin of the diagnosis and its propagation, I would say, is almost lost in myth. There are two explanations given, and the first, you know, may well be correct, that there were a large number of children who were very difficult to manage, very disruptive, you know, created a lot of problems for everybody who had to deal with them, and there really wasn't an effective treatment for these children out there, and they were felt to not be well understood, so that giving them a diagnosis of bipolar disorder initially seemed to have the merit of giving these kids a diagnosis as well as laying out a potential road to treatment of this very difficult population. So that's one speculation about the origin. The second speculation is one provided by Joseph Groopman in The New Yorker, where he describes the head of NIMH, who at the time was Dr. Stephen Hyman, and he describes a large group of parents coming in to see Dr. Hyman, and they were all clutching a book called The Bipolar Child by Dr. Papalopoulos and his wife. And they had read this book, and they were very favorably impressed by the book, and they were insistent that Dr. Hyman develop a research program that would essentially help describe and identify and treat the children that were described in this book. So those are two explanations for how the disorder got started. There may have been other reasons as well, but those are the two explanations that are given.
So now, let me ask book, this. I think it's critical.
Go ahead.
Let me hold you up. The 10, 20 years ago, the school system was different. We had an element of dropouts, but not like it is today. You're looking 25, 30% national average of kids dropping out of school and not finishing high school. Now, has the diagnosis, the level of the diagnosis increased over the last 10 or 15 years? And does the diagnosis and the actual ADD and the bipolar with the onset of what we are seeing in the school system, does that correlate with the diseases we're talking about?
I don't think so. I share, of course, your great concern about the large number of children who aren't graduating high school and the lack of educational competency the children gain in public schools today. It's really deplorable. But I wouldn't blame that, you know, on the diagnosis of bipolar disorder. I mean, some of those children may well suffer from undiagnosed ADHD, but I think it's largely a cultural phenomena. You know, as I'm sure many of your listeners appreciate, there's a lot of social disorganization out there, and the more disorganized home that a child comes from, certainly the less well they're going to do in school in general.
Well, no question.
But I wouldn't attribute that to psychiatric diagnosis. I think it's a very important social and cultural problem that has to be dealt with in some other way than, you know, through making it a medical illness. You know, it's really a cultural and social problem.
Now, by the way, the book in and of itself, I pick the book up and I read it page by page, cover to cover. What's my takeaway, Stuart? What do I get? What do I, Michael Ray, get that I didn't have before I read this book?
Well, the first thing is that if you're a parent who is considering diagnosis of bipolar disorder for their child, who has a child who's been diagnosed, this book will give you a different approach to looking at your child. Will give you an alternative. There are a large number of books out there about bipolar disorder in children, but they're all in favor of the diagnosis. My book is the only one, by and large, that you can turn to for an alternative view. And the second thing that you'll get, I think for even people who don't have children with the diagnosis of bipolar disorder, there's a much deeper understanding of psychiatry as a science and how psychiatry develops its knowledge base, and how culture and psychiatry work together as a system.
Now, by the way, you bring up an interesting point, because culture changes so rapidly. How does psychiatry stay up with the culture? And I think that's a fair question, because kids think differently today. The sensitivity within them is much stronger than it was years ago. 50 years ago, you ran down the street and you fell down and you ran home crying. Your mother slapped a Band-Aid on you and said, you know, go away. Today, you fall down, you get the Band-Aid, but you also get the grievance counselor and you get everything else that goes along with it.
My take on it is that psychiatry is part of the culture. It's like a fish in water. You know, the fish never knows they're in water. They just accept it. And psychiatry is the same way. We're like fish in water. We're surrounded by culture all of the time. And the culture has a dramatic impact on all the decisions we make as psychiatrists. And psychiatry and the mental health professions have a great impact on culture. So we're all swimming in culture. And bipolar disorder in children was a creation of public relations. It was a cultural, socially constructed phenomena, you know, based on books, TV, and even the scientific articles, scientific quote-unquote, that were published about bipolar disorder in children, they also contributed greatly to the cultural acceptance. They were essentially, even though they were scientific studies, that was one purpose that they served, but they certainly also served a vital public relations function for this diagnosis. So I think we're all part of the culture. Psychiatry separates itself from it at its peril, because it will not help them understand what it is that's going on.
Stuart, I have to hold you up. We're starting to run out of the time. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yes. Well, one thing I can mention, I have an article in this week's Newsweek. Name of the article is, it's on the cover, and it's an adaptation from the book. It's called Mommy, Am I Really Bipolar? And you can find that in, I think it's the June 17th Newsweek, page 54. And I'm at, I have a website, one word, you know, www.notchildbipolardisorder.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Stuart Kaplan, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Okay, thanks a lot for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night, Michael. Take care.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Nancy DeVoe with us. She is the author of Healthy, Sexy, and Happy, A Thrilling Journey to the Ultimate You. She's a real food advocate, best-selling health book writer, the author of Healthy, Sexy, Happy, A Thrilling Journey to the Ultimate You, and the novel Karma, a psychological thriller about sex trafficking. And let us say, Nancy, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. A Thrilling Journey to the Ultimate You. I wonder how many people stand in front of that mirror in the morning, and they look in front of that mirror, they take a very deep look into the mirror, and they don't see themselves.
Yeah, I think we do a lot of mental photoshopping. We all certainly do that.
But how do you get past that? When I say how do you get past that, most people don't. We live in a very rapid world today, and most people have no idea who they are. And if you ask them who they are, they'll give you a definition of what somebody thinks that they should be and never get you to that quote-unquote ultimate you. And most people live a very unfulfilling life because there's a delusion there that they don't know how to connect with that fullness.
Right. Well, we live in a really, really confusing time where we're getting lots and lots of messages that are both damaging and unmotivating to people. So I think that a lot of people lose their motivation, unfortunately. And one of my goals is to get people to be more motivated. As you said, I'm a real food advocate. I advocate that people eat real, whole, living food. And a number of things, including getting enough sleep every night, which is, I was thinking that was the topic of this conversation tonight, is insomnia.
It could go anywhere you'd like it to go.
Okay, because I would really like to talk about that, because I do consider myself an expert in insomnia, as a result of having been an insomniac for 30 years. Hmm. And I'd really like to share a little bit about what I know about overcoming insomnia with people, because part of the thrilling journey to an ultimate you is to get 8 hours of sleep every night. And I know that there are millions of people out there who aren't getting sleep.
Now, by the way, well, let's work with the definition, because I think the most important thing we can do is define and get a basis for where we're at, and then we use that as a foundation, then we can build from there. So let's define insomnia. We know it's just, you know, not sleeping, but it's more than that. What is insomnia? She fell asleep. Yeah, all right, you're coming. By the way, insomnia is something that's going to affect a lot of people, but there's a lot of different reasons for doing so. Not sleeping at night. And there's also something called sleep apnea, which is something that a doctor has to handle. One of the things that I found out about sleeping at night, it's a habit. It's a structure. You've got to be able to know what you're doing to be able to go to sleep at night. If you're not in the habit of going to bed at a certain time, guess what? You're not going to fall asleep. Then you're tired all day long, and then you get back to the point of, okay, now I can go to sleep. And guess what happens? You can't go to sleep. So that's enough to drive you nuts in the first place. And, oh, by the way, she's also the author of Death by Supermarket. Anyways, let's plug something in. We'll tell everybody we love them, and we'll be back live and doing stuff tomorrow.
We've shared a moment. And as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting now.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Your cheers and laughter will linger out.